From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Unemployment is at its lowest in nearly 10 years, but nearly 1 in 8 men is out of the labor force entirely, neither working nor even looking for work. That number is higher than what it was at the end of the Depression. So who are these men and what's keeping them out of the job market? Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute explores these questions in his latest book, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. He joins me along with Anibhan Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group and host of the Morning Economic Report on WIPR. The crisis of men who are chronically unemployed, what it means for the workforce, and for the men who live outside of it. First, the news. And good afternoon on this chilly afternoon here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Glad you're with us. Last Friday, the final jobs report of the Obama administration was released. The U.S. economy added 156,000 jobs in December, which was slightly below what many economists had predicted, but which continued an historic streak of months in which the number of jobs grew. It was the 75th month in a row that the economy added jobs, the longest streak since 1939. In addition, average hourly wages were up in 2016, and we finished the year with 4.7% of American workers currently unemployed, a rate that many economists consider to be full employment. My first guest today is an economist who looks at these pretty cheery unemployment figures and says, hold on. He points out that these numbers do not reflect the huge number of people who are not working and not even trying to find a job. While the unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in about 10 years, the work rate for people between the ages of 25 and 54 is slightly lower than it was in 1940 at the end of the Great Depression. And most of those people are men. What are the consequences of what Nicholas Eberstadt calls the flight from work by more than 7 million American men? The consequences for the economy writ large and the consequences for these men and their families. Nick Eberstadt joins me in the studio. He holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. His new book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Nick, it's good to see you.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Tom.
So full disclosure, everybody, Nick Eberstadt is the cousin of the woman to whom I am married, Linnell Smith.
But we still talk to each other.
We still talk to each other, but we tend to see each other at family gatherings rather than at economic forums. But I have read this and your other books that you've produced during the time that Linnell and I have been married. And this one is one that's really getting quite a bit of notice because you call this the invisible crisis of men without work. Let's talk a little bit about the unemployment rate that people, you know, latch on to and pay attention to with great interest and acuity. You talk about the unemployment rate being antiquated and misleading. Why is that?
Because the unemployment rate was quite reasonably devised for a sort of a Dickensian world in which the only two options for a working-age man was to have a job or to be looking for one. In our post-war era, the fastest growing group of working age men has been a third category of men who are neither working nor looking for work, men who are out of the labor force altogether. They, by definition, are not treated by the unemployment rate. And we're now in a situation in the United States where for every one guy of so-called prime working ages, the key 25 to 54 group, who's unemployed, there are three guys who are out of the labor force altogether. So the rate is less and less useful for measuring overall labor market conditions.
What's the actual unemployment rate then? If you factor in the people who aren't even looking, and you add that to the people who are looking but can't find a job, do you have a guess as to it actually is?
I mean, if you look instead at what we might call the work rate, the employment to population ratio, we have a pretty good idea of the number of people who have paid work in relation to the civilian, so-called civilian non-institutional population. And when we look at that, again, for the prime age men. The situation hasn't been so great for women in the 21st century, but I'm focusing on the men because the problem goes back longer and has been deeper there. The work rate for men, whether we're looking at either 25 to 54s or 20 to 64s, you know, take your pick, is a little bit lower than it was in the 1940 census, which you'll recall 1940 was the tail end of the Great Depression. So it's not entirely unreasonable to talk about at least the work crisis for guys as being a sort of a depression scale problem at the moment.
And it's guys in particular. It's not guys and women in the aggregate?
Well, The male aspect of the problem was disguised for a couple of generations by the very big and important transformation in the economic role of women in the United States. In the U.S., like other Western countries, like many other countries around the world, there was a big revolutionary inflow of women into paid employment after World War II. Women always worked, they just didn't always get paid. Now they could get paid outside of the house. The inflow of women, which supplemented work for men, kind of disguised this. But since the year 2000, the work rates for women have also been declining. So men and women are both, I think, kind of suffering from weak labor markets.
But men suffering considerably more than women?
For a longer period of time. The decline in work rates for men goes back to the mid-1960s. The decline for work rates in women began about the year 2000. It hasn't been consistent. You know, it goes with the business cycle, but it's been ratcheting down for both men and women since about the year 2000.
So you're an economist and a demographer. You look at the economies not only the United States, but you're an expert in North Korea. You do a lot of work in Russia. What rate, I mean, is the fact that the unemployment rate does not include these people, you know, one out of four guys who aren't, or three out of four guys who aren't even looking, is that purposeful? I mean, is that, you know, malicious deception, or is it just, you know, the standard measure that people have used and they just haven't decided to change it?
Well, I think the world changes a lot faster than statistical metrics sometimes. Now, if you went up to Wall Street and you asked people, do you pay attention to the unemployment rate? They kind of laugh at you. They'd say, no, tell us what the jobs report is. Tell us how many new jobs are coming in. Tell us what the work rate was. So it's just that there's a little bit of a lag, I think, behind reality. It's good that somebody calculates that rate, but it would be good to pay attention to other things as well.
And where do you get the numbers that help you calculate this other rate? I mean, the way we come up with the unemployment rate is we go to the unemployment office and find out how many people have applied for benefits. How do you find that so many other people aren't doing that?
Well, my secret source is the Census Bureau, which puts out, through the current population survey, the data that's used every month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics for its jobs reports. The headline number is the unemployment rate, but if you look at the rest of the report, it's got tons of stuff in there, and all the rest of the stuff I was just mentioning is in there too. There are some things which I think are very worrisome oversights by the government. The most important, I'd say egregious oversight, is not paying any attention at all to the employment prospects or profiles of people who have been to prison or who have felonies. There may be 20 million men and women today who have got a felony in their background, and the U.S. government somehow just forgot to ask how reentry is working for these people. One in eight adult men. That's a really serious oversight. But with respect to the other data that
and
I was...
They could do that easily. You're just saying that they've just, again, the statistical measures are just lagging behind the... Because obviously this is related to the incarceration rates, which
absolutely.
Are so much higher than they ever used to be.
Absolutely. It's absolutely related to that. It would cost some money to add this to the survey. It would probably take a couple of years to get it all worked out. But in about 2 weeks, the government could start with all of the information that it has through administrative records on the employment situation for people who are on parole or probation. That would take one person about 2 or 3 weeks to just come up with, and that would be an enormous improvement on the benign neglect, not so benign neglect we have today.
So one of your chapters talks about the flight from work.
Mm-hmm.
which indicates that it's a purposeful, not serendipitous occasion or fact that these guys aren't working. They are choosing not to work. They are fleeing from work. What evidence do you have that that's the case, as opposed to the fact that maybe they're trying to find jobs and there's just no jobs out there for their skill level?
The Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics ask people who are neither working nor looking for work, why are they out of the labor force? And at this point in time, in recent years, only about 1 in 7 of the 7 million prime-age guys who are out of the labor force say they are out of the labor force because they can't find a job. The other 6/7 of this group, the other 6 million men, say they are out of the labor force for other reasons. And there are a variety of reasons, including disability, including helping out at home, including studying, lots of other reasons. But the classic definition of the discouraged worker does not seem to go very far in accounting for this growing group of disconnected, detached men, not part of the labor force. And if you look at the decline in workforce participation, this accounts for almost all of the decline in work rates for men over the last 50 years.
So discouraged worker is the worker who's looking but can't find a job. Then there's the marginalized worker who's working part-time and wishes he or she were working full-time.
Yep.
But the unemployment rate does not include those people who are working part-time.
Right. So you would be included, one would be included in the employed workforce if you got a minimum wage job that paid you for an hour a week. You would still be included as a worker.
Yeah, you'd be considered employed. What's the statistical portrait of these guys who are out of the labor force completely? And how do you come about a portrait of what is almost surely a set of perhaps millions of different individual reasons?
Well, I can't come up with the human story of 7 million different people. You know, it's like the 7 million different stories in the naked jungle, right? What I can do is take a look at what the Census Bureau says about the demographic, social, economic characteristics of these 7 million guys. And of course, if it's a group of 7 million guys, you're going to have some of everybody in America in there. But there are groups that are overrepresented. In terms of ethnicity, African Americans are definitely overrepresented. Interestingly enough, among people of color, Latinos are more likely to be in the workforce than Americans as a whole. In terms of education, less skilled, no high school degree guys are way overrepresented in this group. In terms of family, married guys are much more likely to be in the workforce than the national average. Guys who have never been married or don't have kids at home are disproportionately likely to be part of the unworking pool.
And for example, you say that even people of color who are married,
yes,
have higher work rate participation than Caucasian workers who are not married.
Yeah. Pardon the verb, but marriage trumps race in that case. So marriage is a very powerful predictor of workforce involvement for any ethnicity or educational level. And then it also turns out that nativity, whether you're born in America or whether you're an immigrant, matters a lot to workforce profile. People from abroad are much more likely to be in the workforce than guys who were born in the United States. Black guys who were born overseas have higher workforce participation than white guys who were born in America.
And this kind of information is findable in the census reports.
It's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we will have more on this when we come back from a break. Nicholas Eberstadt is a political economist with the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. We'll have more with Nick Eberstadt after we do take that break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Anibon Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group. We'll also take your calls and emails and tweets and carrier pigeons and however else you want to get us a message. 410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And if you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. More on Men Without Work. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, a preview of the General Assembly. Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun and Rachel Bay of the WIPR news team join me to talk about what we can expect from the session, which begins Wednesday morning in Annapolis. If you've just joined us today, we're talking with Nicholas Eberstadt about his new book, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 million men are currently not working and not looking for a job. Joining us in the studio as well now is Anibon Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group, an economic consulting firm. He's also the host of the Morning Economic Report here on WIPR. Anibon, good to see you.
Privilege.
And by the way, we should note that the fact that Anibon's show is underwritten here at WIPR has not a darn thing to do with the fact that we asked Anibon to come, because we are here because Anibon covers and studies these things as closely as Nick Eberstadt. So, Anibon, when you hear Nick talk about this, really, this incredible crisis, I mean, it was an awakening for me to read this book and see just how many men in particular are out of work. What's your reaction?
Yeah, and it's all kinds of men, meaning in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I'm doing a study right now of the labor market in Cecil County, Maryland, and you see incredible numbers of men in their 50s and 60s who are in this situation, not working, not looking for work. They're not even necessarily discouraged, because if you ask them, would you like to have a job, they're not even sure that they'd want to have a job. I mean, they're just out. And there's all kinds of reasons for this. It's very frustrating, because at the same time, and you know, one of the things that Nick pointed out was data come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Their JOLTS survey, the Job Opportunities and Labor Turnover Survey, indicates that America has never had more job openings than does right now. So if people think that, well, these men are out of work because there's just not enough jobs out there, there's actually a lot of jobs. And then people will point out, well, yeah, but they're not very good jobs. But actually, some of them are decent jobs. You know, construction firms will tell you they can't find carpenters, can't find welders, can't find electricians. People, others will say they can't find truck drivers or mechanics and so on and so forth, machinists. And so some of these jobs, yes, require a lot of training, experience, so on and so forth. But they're out there, and they go begging each and every day. And many of them are associated with middle incomes.
So, Nick, what about this? I mean, there are if the critics of your book and of your research point to the fact that you don't give enough weight to the supply and demand effect in any economy, and that the jobs simply aren't out there. As Anibon is saying, though, there's a lot of jobs that can't be filled because there's a skills gap in between what people know how to do and the jobs that, require skills. But what's your reaction to that? How's that fit in?
Well, of course, the problem we have in the United States is a result of demand problems, of supply problems, and of institutional barriers, which is to say it's partly globalization and the decline of manufacturing. It's partly the withholding of work in the kind of ways that Dr. Basu was describing. It's also part of this incarceration problem I mentioned, which is big barriers. Every rich country has seen a decline in the workforce participation for prime-age men over the last two generations. The mystery is why the U.S. has had the very worst of the rich countries' decline, because we don't have the most generous social welfare programs, and we haven't had the worst economic growth by a long shot of various affluent countries. So certainly the globalization aspect is one part of it, but here's a kind of a curious mystery. If we had a really functioning burgeoning national labor force. You'd expect that after a big shock, there'd be a kind of an equalization, an equilibrium in labor markets across the U.S. What we see instead is that the workforce participation rate of different states are really disparate from one another, and they're getting more and more disparate, so that Maine has got one of the worst workforce participation rates for guys, but it borders on New Hampshire, which has one of the best. There are things that are going on that can't be entirely described by as demand-side problems.
410-662-8780 is the number to call to join us here on Midday with Nick Eberstadt. His new book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. And Anibon Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group. 410-662-8780. An email address is midday@wipr.org and our Twitter handle at @MiddayTomHall. So Anibon, Nick points out in the book that there is this growing divergence between wealth, output, and employment. So wealth is being concentrated in the hands of fewer people than ever before. Productivity and employment, these three things, general wealth of people and output and employment, normally move together. But now they're diverging. They're not moving. Why is that?
No, there's so many reasons. Ultimately, from an economist perspective, productivity is the arbiter of living standards. And one of the things we have seen in America, but this is true in other societies as well, is productivity growth has really slowed. One of the mysteries is why that is. But on average, the American worker is not becoming significantly more productive 1 year to the next. And no surprise, their wages are not growing very rapidly from 1 year to the next. Now, wage growth has picked up recently, that's true, but not because productivity growth has picked up. At the same time, we have enormous amounts of entrepreneurial opportunities for people. People like Jeff Bezos, for instance, at Amazon.com, who can take advantage of the global marketplace, of technologies that are emerging. Last I checked, his Amazon stock was worth $67 billion. I mean, he's more valuable than certain countries. So, you know, we have this disparity, this discrepancy. And I think one of the things that it does is it breeds cynicism. You know, people look at this and they say, my goodness, this is just not fair. It's an unbalanced playing field. So I'm not going to play whatsoever. And that might be part of the reason we're observing some of these folks leaving altogether this economic structure of ours.
So, Nick, is there really solid data about the particular reasons that these guys are doing what Anibon is suggesting here, just bowing out? For example, we talk a lot now about the opioid epidemic here in the United States, which certainly Maryland is feeling in a very fierce way. In the city of Baltimore, as many people who were victims of homicide last year, more people died because of opioid overdoses. So that's clearly a problem. Is in terms of causality,
yep.
Which comes first, that chicken or that egg? And is that did you find any of that causality when you're doing your research? Are there specific reasons we know that these guys just are giving up?
Well, certainly this fall, the study that was published by Alan Krueger of Princeton, President Obama's former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, that detailed how almost half of the unworking prime-age men are regularly taking pain medication. That was a pretty grim portrait of what's going on for a lot of people who have kind of who are out of the labor force. I think that to get a really good view of how things work for human beings, you're not going to use data with decimal points and margins of error. You're going to go to something like that wonderful book that J.D. Vance did, Hillbilly Elegy, that came out last year, which gave such a fantastic view of what life was like in Ohio and Appalachian Kentucky. We probably need to have dozens of really good journalists, really good anthropologists go out into American communities and give a human face to these sorts of numbers that I've just kind of assembled before we can get a really empathetic human scale view of this problem.
So Anibon, Nick mentions in the book that the work rate has declined some 4% in the post-World War II era. If we were at 2000 levels, the level that of work participation that we were in the year 2000, as many as 10 million more people might be working. If that were the case, what would the impact on the GDP be? What would the impact on the economy be?
It would be massive. I mean, you're adding good 6 or 7% to the number of working Americans. It'd be enormous. But also, it's more than that because there's less demand for social assistance. So now all of a sudden those tax dollars can be spent more aggressively on infrastructure or on education as opposed to simply keeping people alive and, you know, holding them up to some minimal living standard. And so it would be utterly transformational if you have a higher labor force participation rate. That's true, by the way, in Baltimore City. If we get more people to work, more adult age folks to work, and again, the question is, well, why aren't they? They're not trained, they don't have public transportation, they don't have childcare, all kinds of, they have records, you know, criminal backgrounds, so on and so forth, they can't pass a drug test, whatever it happens to be. This is true of communities across the country. It's not just a Baltimore issue. But the impacts would be simply transformational if we had more people pulling the rope. I mean, one of the reasons I think the U.S. economy has only been growing around 2% since the recession ended in mid-2009 is not enough people are working. But then the question becomes, and I think Nick hit it right on the head, this is not about decimal points or, you know, kind of numeric analysis. It's about asking people, what's going on in your life? What's holding you back? Are you satisfied with your life? Are you satisfied not being part of the labor market? Or would you find more satisfaction if you get there? You just don't think you can get there.
Anibon Basu is the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group. He's here in Studio A along with Nick Eberstadt. His new book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. I'm Tom Hall. To call midday and join the conversation, 410-662-8780. To drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. And to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Severn, welcome to Midday with Nick Eberstadt and Anibon Basu.
Hi, Nick, Tom, and Anibon. I had a question for Nick. Regarding the statistics that you've organized, I haven't seen your book, but it would be interesting to me to know if there would be like a pie chart that would break out the percentages of the folks that aren't working so that you have those that are studying in college, for example, those that are in early retirement, those that are on some kind of disability, and then the folks that are left over, and understanding, you know, really what the real number is. Because when you lay in the ones that have a legitimate reason for not being in the workforce, I think the statistics would look a little different. And then how you break it out from there as to whether or not it's a human condition type of an issue, whether it's motivation, persistence, or lack of opportunity.
All right, thanks for your call, Mike. And Nick, this is something that you take up
explicitly. That's an excellent question. And I'll try to break it down very quickly. If we look at people over the age of 55, that's the only group of American guys whose work rate is actually increasing. Over the last generation, over the last 20-some years, that has been going up. That's like the little ray of sunshine, is people who are actually heading towards retirement age, but are actually more likely to be working than in the past. When we look at the prime age guys, the 25 to 54s, we wouldn't think that many of them should be retired. A tiny little sliver of them are retired, but not too many. The one in eight, let's say, prime age guys who are out of the labor force altogether include the 7 million, includes about 1 million who are adult students. And they're basically training to get back into the game, to improve their skills, to get back into the labor force. Here's what I think Mike would find fascinating, is what the time use surveys show. So for the adult students who are out of the labor force, they spend their time more or less like employed guys. You know, they're studying, they're doing other sorts of things like that. They're actually fairly helpful in their communities and stuff. When you look at the other men who are detached from the workforce, what the Brits would call NEET, N-E-E-T, neither employed nor in education or training, you get a very different and a pretty grim picture. They report through time use surveys for the BLS that they basically
It's the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Through the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They report that they basically don't do civil society. They don't volunteer. They don't do charitable work. They don't do religious activities. They don't help out much around the house with kids or with other household members. They don't do chores as much as employed women, who are like the most time poor people in the whole tableau I've just described. What they do instead is watch TV, DVDs, internet screens. It's a 2,100-hour-a-year occupation, basically like a job. And the scary thing about that, in addition to the lost human potential and the humanity of this, is the question of how people's skills are affected by this. A woman may be out of the labor force as a mom for a number of years, but if she tries to get back into the labor force, she will not have been idle at all during this time. She doesn't get sick days. She has to show up for her. She does all sorts of things that employers appreciate, no matter what level of educational attainment. We have to wonder what happens to men's employability over the long term from this sort of an approach.
Anibon, here's an email from John who says many are forecasting that artificial intelligence, things like self-driving trucks and other innovations, will eliminate the jobs of 25% to 40% of the workforce by some predictions. And this may be some years off, John writes, but he says, how will we as a society respond when many of us define our self-worth and dignity by our work? So again, weaving that human face into a very macroeconomic problem.
I know you've invited me to be on this show to be useful. In response to this question, I'm utterly useless. Why? I don't know. It is scary. I can tell you that. The notion of robotics, artificial intelligence, driverless vehicles, and all kinds of other technologies replacing more of us. And, you know, for a long time, we've been accustomed to this notion that technology would replace the blue-collar worker. That was largely in manufacturing, where workers would lose their jobs due to technology. But that for much of the balance of us, technology would actually create employment opportunities, whether in the life sciences or cybersecurity or just in general healthcare delivery. Now, it's a different story, isn't it? I mean, you have cash registers that just spit out change. You don't need a human being. Amazon is going to have stores where you can walk in and walk out, and you don't need anyone to help you pay. And so what happens then? You know, we're already very bifurcated as a society between the haves and have-nots. The impact of technology could separate us even further. And we can see that society is not working that well right now. We're divided. Can you imagine what the impact of this technology is going to be? And there might actually be some who will say, and my mother is one of them, we don't need all this technology. Just let's stop right now. But of course, that's not going to happen. So I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think there's going to be some profoundly negative outcomes from this spread of technology, and all the jobs are going to be destroyed.
All right. Lots more to talk about. Lots of folks lined up to be with us on the phone, and we will get to those calls when we come back. Nicholas Eberstadt is an economist and demographer at the American Enterprise Institute. His new book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Anibon Basu is the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group based here in Baltimore. We'll have more on the reasons that there's so many men who are not working after a break. But before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has been compiling a list of Baltimore homicide victims for the past 15 years. And we also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which they've been keeping since 2007. So far in this nascent new year, six people have already been victims of homicide in our city. These are the people who were killed in Baltimore last week. Keith Patterson, age 39. Shaman Purley, age 20, James Williams, age 33, Devontae Jackson, age 24, Jamal Washington, age 38, and Timothy Stevens. He was 32 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Thanks, Matt, and welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Anibon Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group, and Nicholas Eberstadt. He's a political economist at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Midday at WIPR.org is the email address, and at Midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Andrew in Baltimore County, welcome to Midday with Nick Eberstadt and Anibon Basu.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you feeling?
I just wanted to bring up the point. I live in a middle-class white neighborhood mostly, and it's pretty diverse, but I did notice among my neighbors that a lot of them are their wives have a higher education than them, and so they tend to get a better pay rate than their husbands, and if their husbands aren't making enough money to basically pay for daycare and the mortgage and everything else, that it's just more economical for a husband without necessarily an education. I actually seen statistics that women do better in college and that more women are getting degrees. That just doesn't make sense for someone with skilled labors that doesn't make as much money as their wife to go into the workforce. And so that's just the point I was trying to make.
What do you mean it doesn't make sense? Why wouldn't they want to go into the workforce for a whole bunch of reasons?
Because if they're, for example, I work for the federal government, and my entire paycheck, portion of my paycheck goes into daycare. I have two kids in daycare. So at the end of the month, I pretty much bring in nothing. My wife pays for the mortgage. She pays for everything else. Now, if I was making a little less than what I'm making now at my grade level in the government, I would have had to quit my job, and I would have just stayed at home and watched the kids. My wife has a higher education than me, and she makes a lot more money than me. And it's pretty much true throughout the entire neighborhood for most of the people in my age category. I'm 32. Most of my neighbors are on the same age as me, 35, 36. The older men in my neighborhood, they actually work. They're in their 50s. They work. Their wives aren't as educated with me, but as I see for my age group, there's, and then other people in my neighborhood are like pre-med students or are going to like John Hopkins, and they move out usually after 5 years when they actually get to medical school. So it just seems like it doesn't make any sense for a lot of my neighbors as men to work because they just don't make as much money.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Andrew. Anibon, Nick writes in his book that there's also a generational difference here, and he says it's impossible to imagine men in other generations reconciling themselves in such tremendous numbers to a daily routine of idleness. Do you think that's part of it?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a cultural phenomenon here that there was a time when, you know, there were certain behaviors that were expected of you. You went to church on Sunday, you worked during the week, and you might have had a day off on Saturday. But that, you know, there was a conformity there. And I think, you know, it's not there yet. Whether that's good or bad, you be the judge. People can be the judge. But yeah, I think part of this is a breakdown of certain cultural norms that people had grown up with in previous generations, but just don't really exist very much anymore.
Is there, Nick Eberstadt, any particular data about generation? I mean, you mentioned that the guys over the age of 55 are working more. Are the younger, in this prime age working thing, the 25 to 54s, is it more the 25 to 30s that are, you know, really exhibiting this?
The best trait? Predictor for workforce participation disposition is what year you were born in. And younger brothers are less likely to be in the labor force than older brothers. Older brothers are less likely to be in the labor force than their dads. The dads are less likely to be in the labor force than their older brothers if you hold everything else constant. That's for up to age 55. After that, we're seeing a positive trend, but that's mainly for people who have skills, who are more educated, who would be more affluent to begin with.
Mike in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Nick Eberstadt and Anibon Basu.
Yeah, hi. Hello?
Hi, Mike. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, how are you? I've personally experienced this, so I can sympathize because I lost my business at the age of 50 and spent 4 or 5 years, you know, just trying to find a decent-paying job. And it was hell. I almost gave up. And finally, I found a job at one of the casinos, and I'm dealing cards and making decent money.
So you were 50 years old when your business...
the recession. I had a real estate publishing business, and the recession, you know, plus the internet just killed it. And, you know, there was no way back. You know, and my brother is also, you know, a victim of this because, you know, he was a convicted felon. And, you know, he's had a hell of a time.
Do you think your difficulty in finding work, it took you 4 or 5 years, did that have to do with your age or your skill level or your education? I mean, what do you credit
it? I'm a college graduate. I don't have a master's degree or anything like that. You know, I ran my business for 20 years. So, you know, I think, you know, I had decent skills. It was just that a lot of employers wouldn't take that seriously, you know, because it was a small business. You know, hard to document, that kind of thing. And I think there is some age discrimination involved. You know, and a lot of these guys too, you know, they were carpenters or plumbers or, you know, maybe got injured. So, you know, they're kind of beat up.
Well, Mike, thank you for your call, and I'm glad you got hired by a casino and that you're back to getting a paycheck. I appreciate the call. So, Nick Eberstadt, you talk a lot about education levels here and educational attainment, but again, these factors that affect it are all interrelated, so that married people with low education levels sometimes have higher work participation rates than college-educated unmarried guys.
Sure. Well, what Mike just told us, and I think this is really admirable, is that he's had the courage and the persistence to try again and again while he's getting the door slammed in his face, and he's ended up with a success. In the face of what may be forbidding odds due to educational disadvantage or other factors, people can change the outlook depending upon their motivation and their attitude and their persistence. They can change their personal odds to some degree. That's what we see with men who are married. That's what we see with men who are immigrants. It's not the marriage ring. It's not the green card that gives them some special advantage. There's a whole set of other attitudes and outlooks that have come along with it on average.
Here's a tweet from somebody whose Twitter handle is MobTownShank, who asks, is there any correlation between the mass of underemployed men and the rise of the alt-right? Anibon, Donald Trump talked about, you know, the forgotten white working class. He was fairly specific about it. Are these folks who aren't working and aren't looking, are they the people who are voting for change in Washington?
Probably disproportionately. You know, one of the comments, it was a while ago, but Hillary Clinton made a comment about coal miners in West Virginia and indicating that they were going to lose their job and they were going to be put out of work. But she said it in such a way that it gave the impression that maybe she was almost gleeful about it. She didn't mean it that way at all. But I think that stuck with a lot of people. And there certainly are a lot of displaced manufacturing workers in Ohio and Michigan and in Wisconsin. And I think that group went heavily toward Donald Trump. And by the way, I think in many cases, the women in their lives went heavily for Donald Trump because the women in their lives often look at these guys and say, he's not happy. He's not well. And here's a presidential candidate who's saying, I care about him. I want him to do better. I'm going to bring his job back. And if they're going to make him feel better, I'm going to vote for him too, you know, irrespective of some of the other issues out there around this gentleman. And so, yeah, I think that was a big part of it. The fact of the matter is that what turned this election around was Michigan and Wisconsin. And there's certainly a demographic attached to those states, an industrial heritage that to a certain extent has been lost that explains this campaign's outcomes.
Nick Eberstadt, we have an email from Michelle who says, do you have statistics on what these men are doing for income if they're not in the labor force? So how are they eating?
I've got a chapter in this book which tries to look at that. It's limited by the reliability and the gaps in our official data on income.
And you mentioned that people are self-reporting this.
People are
self-reporting. And when it comes to statistics, that's always treacherous thing.
You try to adjust for it. It's not perfect. You know, what did Dr. Gregory House tell us about people? Everybody's a liar. I mean, something like that, right? You know, so but you try to do the best
in
you can.
In his esteemed erudite opinion.
Right, exactly. But you have to deal with what you can find. So It looks from the numbers as if, on the whole, these unworking men are supported by their families, by their girlfriends or others, and by Uncle Sam. And the important part of the Uncle Sam aspect of the story, I think, has become disability insurance and disability payments. The U.S. government does not comprehensively track disability payments. It's kind of amazing considering the hundreds of billions of dollars that are spent every year. But in going to one particular source of census information that I used, which tracks government benefit programs, almost three-fifths of the unworking prime-age guys said they obtained at least one disability program benefit. And about a quarter of those who were getting any disability benefits were getting two different benefits or more. So this isn't a princely way to live. It's a terrible waste of human potential, but it makes a feasible alternative to employment.
So the implication there is that they're faking it, they're not actually disabled, and they're on the government dole. And you hear stories about this all the time. You know, you have court cases all the time. But you think that
no way I can tell that from the, mm-hmm. There's no way. I mean, people don't say I'm faking it, and that's how you know right. What I'm doing. There's really no way to look at this from a distance and say what the individual circumstances of people are. You can tell that this is increasingly becoming a sort of an alternative to paid employment, and you can tell that people are taking an awful lot of painkillers. But what the actual disability circumstances are, I can't tell. I mean, you may deal with this a lot.
The only thing I would say is that, you know, if somebody has a disability, somebody has a disability. And you should not see a spike in people on disability during a recession. Right? Mm. It's not as if more people have. But we did see a spike in people on disability during the recession, during the aftermath of the recession. So it said that some people who had been working, who viewed themselves as fit enough to work, all of a sudden did not find themselves.
We've had seven recessions in the last 20 years. But you're saying this last one, which was clearly the, you know, the granddaddy of all recessions that we've had in our lifetime, there's an uptick in this last one in particular.
Yeah, I think that's right. And maybe it's just our demographics, right? So many baby boomers are now in their 50s and 60s, you know, and saying, oh, you know, I've lost my job. It's going to be hard for me. And one of the previous callers mentioned discrimination. There probably is some discrimination mm-hmm. against older workers. I don't doubt that. And so they said, you know, maybe I can find another
and
source of
income. And discrimination against people of color. I mean, that's not new. I mean, that's not new.
I agree with that, too. That's not new either. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm happy the labor market is improving, because it makes discrimination more painful if you're not filling unfilled jobs. But the point is, you shouldn't see that spike in disability, but we did.
Scott in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Anibon Basu and Nick Eberstadt.
Good evening, good afternoon, gentlemen. Tom, I just wanted to mention about the early start of this phenomenon. I think it's earlier in the game, high school level, that our young men are not applying themselves to what is needed to be able to function in the workforce. And, of course, it ends up that the women in their lives, the significant others, earn a lot more than themselves, and they just decide it's not worth it to go out there and even work. So they hang out on the corner.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you for your call. We're running out of time, so I'm going to let Nick comment on that. I mean, if they're not applying themselves as high school kids, these are the folks who could end up on the couch as 30-year-olds.
There's also the aspect of not applying yourself and getting in trouble with the law. From the homework I was able to do in this book, it looked to me as if guys who go to prison are way more likely to be out of the workforce, regardless of their ethnicity, education, age, than guys who've only got an arrest in their background. And guys who have an arrest in their background are way more likely to be out of the labor force than guys who have never gotten in trouble. It's commonsensical, but we can find the information that backs it up.
Jerry in Baltimore, we got about 20 seconds. How about a quick question for our guests?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I went through two recessions, and I've had entire industries collapse on me, had retrained myself, and I'm only 38. I've just found that the work available now is underpaid. There's no benefits. In many cases, I get 1099, and I have to pay a bunch in taxes. I don't get any help from the government. I take odd jobs under the table. I'm working in the food industry, which is the bubble here. The restaurant bubble is about to burst. And I think a lot of people are just tired of running that race
sure.
and not
Jerry,
sure where to go from here.
Yeah, Jaron, I apologize for having to cut you off, but I think you are typical of a lot of workers, certainly the folks that Nick is writing about in this book. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both of you. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming in. Nick Eberstadt holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. His new book, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Anibon Basu, the chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group based here in Baltimore. He hosts the Morning Economic Report here on WIPR at 7:33 every morning. More information on our website, wipr.org/midday. Thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Appreciate your tuning in. Come in, join us again tomorrow where we'll talk about the upcoming Maryland General Assembly with Aaron Cox, who writes about the assembly for the Baltimore Sun, and Rachel Bay, who covers Annapolis for WIPR. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.